Welcome to episode 49 of the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined, as always, by my very well-rated co-host, Perry Middlemiss. How are you, Perry?
G'day, David. I'm all right. Thank you very much. Pretty good.
Doing a fair bit of reading lately, I believe.
Yes, some of it is difficult, but we struggle on. Reading a lot of short fiction for an essay I'm going to be writing coming up in a few months' time. It's going to be a lot of reading to do for that, but I'm gradually working my way through it. A couple of short stories, maybe a novelette every day. Gradually builds up and you get through it. Unfortunately, the novels this last month have been a little bit slow, shall we say. Not really getting through them as fast as I would like to, but that's all right. Every now and again, you're going to have 1 month or so where things don't go so well. And it's quite strange, isn't it, that I find if I really struggle with a book, it can actually set back my reading flow. It's almost like you lose your rhythm in terms
and you
sort of feel as though I've had a bit of feeling about thoughts about this previously, and it's almost like when you get to the point where you can't seem to find a book that's really grabs you, you almost need to have a set of comfort reads sitting over there that you can go back to and go, okay, I'll read this.
Yes.
And once I read this, I'll read it like in a day and a half and I go, oh, now I feel a heck of a lot better.
Yeah.
And I used to have those. That's a set of those that I used to read. You remember when I spoke about favourite books of all time and I spoke about the Adam Hall Quiller series? I used to read those, and there was about 20 or so in those, and I could pick up any one of them. And I know that it would be standalone, but I knew the character that I was getting. I knew it was going to be 200 pages, and you'd fly through it in 2 days, and you'd be back up to speed again. And off you go, you just read whatever you want.
Yeah.
But I've read them so often, I don't really feel like going back and reading them anymore.
Yeah, my equivalent of those is the Dick Francis books, all of which I believe were written by Mary Francis's wife.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. I wasn't aware of that.
Well, there isn't. I mean, he was a jockey, and doubtless he was a capable person. But there's been rumours for years that it was really Mary Francis that wrote them all. He just supplied the racing knowledge.
Oh, okay.
And when she died, the books just went, downhill enormously.
All right. So he didn't do the right thing. He should have died first.
Well, that's right.
Then she could have released books after his death, saying, "Well, these were notes that he left, and I've sort of just finished them off for him."
But I find those books very, very entertaining and enjoyable. But like you with your Quiller books, I've read them so many times. It's just I couldn't possibly go back and read them again. It would sicken me almost. But I enjoyed those some years ago.
So I've got to find a new comfort read, but there we go.
Indeed. All right.
Anyway, moving on, I wanted to have a bit of a chat about a couple of things. Firstly, Hugo nominations for the Hugo Awards for 2021. The nomination period has now closed. The convention has noted that they received a total of 1,246 ballots that were received, which sounds like a good number, but it's down a bit on the last few years.
Okay.
Con New Zealand had 1,584. I think AussieCon 4 at the time we had the record, and that was a touch under 1,000. So it's been gradually going up for about the last 10 odd years.
Yeah.
And what the people involved in the Hugo Awards have been attempting to do is to get more people into nominating. And so they're spreading the word that you don't have to have read everything. You don't have to fill out every single category. You can just put one book down. If there's one book that you've liked in the year, you can put that down as best novel, or one story, or one film that you liked, or one episode of a TV series. So that's been working really well, and that's been increasing the number over and over. But this is a bit of a blip, and this might be COVID related somehow.
Who knows? Yeah.
God alone knows how. Might just be, could be any number of reasons, but still 1,246 is still a goodly number. So the Hugo Awards nominating period, as I said, is now finished. They have also announced that the shortlists, that is what's going to be on the ballot, will be announced in mid-April. So they are quite short. Well, the good thing about it is the vast bulk of people put it in online. And because as soon as it goes into the database, it just gets updated and blam, off it goes.
Yep.
And you don't need to worry about it. I think the number of paper ballots they get is like 20, maybe 50. And it doesn't take you that long to code that in if you've got people sitting, a couple of people sitting around, a few beers, put it all in, and away you go, and then it's fine. So the online process makes it a lot easier for everybody to be able to do in the first instance, which is probably why the numbers have increased as well, but also the number of the low number of paper ballots is quite good. So I've got a feeling that the Hugo ballot ballots will be out just after our next episode is recorded, which seems to be the way. We missed the Nebulas last time, now we're going to miss the Hugos next time.
Yep.
But we'll get it in the fortnight after that. So as soon as the news becomes available that we're able to talk about it, we shall talk about it. Speaking of the Nebula Awards, which is the awards that are given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America for works published in English in the United States in the year under consideration, namely 2020, those awards have the ballot, well, the works that are on the shortlist have now been released. So I thought I might just mention those if I can. The first that you and I will be happy to hear about is that Piranesi by Susanna Clarke is on the list. This is a fantasy novel we've discussed. Now, we've also discussed the Goodreads site that both you and I use to keep track of our reading. And I had a bit of a look at the current ratings. Now, a lot of these books have got 5, 6, 8, 10, 15,000 ratings. So one or two more ratings is not going to change these figures. This is about where they're going to end up.
Yeah.
And I thought it would just be interesting to give a bit of a an indication of what those ratings were for each of those. So I had a bit of a look at them. So Piranesi Fantasy, 4.32 out of 5. Pretty good. The City We Became by N.K. Jemisin. This is the first in a new series. This is another fantasy. You might remember that N.K. Jemisin won 3 Hugos in a row, finishing up a couple of years back. This novel, 3.99, so touch under 4. The next one is Mexican Gothic by Silvia Marino Garcia, which is a horror novel which has been getting a lot of good reviews around the place. Don't normally see much horror on the Hugo on the Nebula ballot or on the Hugo ballot, but anyway, this is got 3.71, which is actually the lowest of the books here. The next one that we have is The Midnight Bargain by C.L. Polk. This is a standalone fantasy, 3.78. Polk won the World Fantasy Award for Best Novel a couple of years ago with a book that I read, whose name completely escapes me at the moment, but which I thought was pretty good. I mean, I've got so many titles in my head, I could look it up.
But yeah, fair enough.
Too many other things going on at the moment. So anyway, so this is the standalone. It's not in, she's finished the trilogy of books of which that World Fantasy Award winner was the first, and then there were two others, and this is another one that she's put out in 2020. That got a rating of 3.78. Black Sun by Rebecca Roanhorse. She won a Hugo Award for Best Short Story a couple of years back and was also nominated a year or two back for a novel. This is the first book in a new trilogy with a rating of 4.26. And the last one, which has the highest rating, is Network Effect by Martha Wells. This is the first novel in the Murderbot series after the 4 novellas. I think you, did you read one or two of those?
No, I haven't been able to get into them, mate.
Oh, yeah. I know all your taste was in your mouth, David, but, you know, these are good stories.
I haven't given her a fair try.
No, I don't think you have. And you have to.
I keep trying to get into the first Murderbot novella and not,
don't succeed. Just can't do it? Oh, I can't.
I'll give it another try.
This has got a rating of 4.44. Now, I've only read one of these novels, so I've got a bit to read if I want to read this, but I've got the Hugo Awards coming up, so I think there will be I reckon of the novels here on this list, I would say that Piranesi, Network Effect, and possibly The City We Became will be on the Hugo ballot as well.
Mm.
Don't take my word for it. I just think that that's probably the way it's going to go.
Sure.
Now, the novellas, there are some very difficult names to pronounce here, so I don't think I'm really going to try and wreck it for you. There are one, two, three, six on the novella ballot, as well as six being on the novel ballot. The only one of which I have read is Ring Shout by P. DeGelly Clark. That was interesting, and I may need to talk about that at some point. It's a sort of an alternate history set in the 1920s, where the Ku Kluxes are sort of monsters that might be alien monsters that have converting people in the Klan into Ku Kluxes. And there's a mythical, there's a woman with a mythical sword, and it is rather complicated, and I'd have to go back and redo it. Some of these things, when you finish reading them and you get there and you think, oh, yeah, no, not really. Don't really like that very much. But they just won't go away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And they just keep coming back and they keep coming back. And sometimes you think, that was actually better than I thought it was after I read it, because I'm still thinking about it.
Oh, sure.
And I think this is one, Reach Out, I think, is one of those that has done it to me. I've got others, one of the ones I'm going to be talking about today, which I think is not as good as I thought it was when I finished.
Mm.
And so I'm actually thinking that I should reduce my rating on that one. But anyway, that's all by the by. So, of course, there's a whole lot of other categories as well. But if I was to go through them, that was the only thing we'd ever talk about for this whole episode. And I really haven't done any reading of 2020 novelettes and short stories, so I would not be able to comment on those at all.
Okay.
But as I said, I've only read one of the novels and one of the novellas for these. The winners of the Nebulas will be announced over the first weekend in June, I believe. That normally is a Nebula weekend in-person conference.
Uh-huh.
This year it's going to be another
virtual one.
It is looking more likely that the Worldcon will also be virtual from Washington. That's just the way things are going this year until the vaccines kick in and the pandemic calms down, especially in the US. So... anyway, so that's what has caught my interest of late. What have you been up to, David?
Well, I've been doing a lot of work for Standard eBooks. We talked about Standard eBooks at length a couple of episodes ago as part of the volunteering work we do. So most of my reading over the last, well, certainly since the last episode, has been works for Standard eBooks. And it turns out they're both of the books I've been working on are Australian titles. And so I thought maybe we'd have a look at Australian books this time around, which I think you've been reading Australian books too. But the ones I've been reading are sort of Australian classics. Now, I didn't grow up in Australia, so my excuse for not having read a lot of the Australian classics before is that I was born in another country. But one of the good things about Standard eBooks is that it pushes me to read some classic books I hadn't come across before or hadn't read before. And in this case, these were Australian classics. So that's what I thought I'd talk about. So we're sort of adopting an Australian books theme. So the first book I would want to talk about, which actually wasn't recent, I did it a couple of years ago, but still it fits into this category, so I thought I'd talk about it anyway, briefly, and that's Such Is Life, an Australian classic by Joseph Furphy. And that was written under the pseudonym of Tom Collins, and it was published in 1903. So I'd heard about this and never actually read it. And it famously opens with the words, "Unemployed at last." Great phrase.
We both appreciate that, yeah.
Unemployed at last. And it purports to be a series of diary entries by the author, this fictitious Tom Collins. And it's the diary entries are at approximately one-month intervals during late 1883 and early 1884. So basically this Tom Collins is some sort of minor government official. I can never quite actually work out what his job is, but whatever it is, as this job, he travels through rural New South Wales and Victoria, and he interacts and talks at length with a variety of really interesting characters, including the drivers of bullock teams, itinerant swagmen, boundary riders and squatters. And it has really, really good descriptions of the Australian bush and the rural lifestyle and the effects of drought. It's quite long. It's 175,000 words. And there are bits in it which were a bit difficult to read because he tries to reproduce dialect from a variety of different places, including Yorkshire, which is where I come from, actually. But I still had trouble working out the dialect that he's trying to reproduce. So that's a bit of a struggle. But nevertheless, I really enjoyed the book. It's full of lots of entertaining and amusing passages. There's a whole really funny segment in there where he loses his clothes when he's crossing a river. And he has to scout around almost naked, you know, behind trees and behind bushes and behind sheds and things, trying to steal at least a pair of trousers so he's decent again. And people sort of spot him as he's doing this, and it sort of frightens people left, right and center. And then the newspapers come out with an article which he reads later called saying that there's a homicidal maniac on the loose. So this was the character Tom Collins. So that's fun. But there's also some very sad and touching incidents in the book, such as the search for a child who's been lost in the bush and comes to a sort of tragic end. So that's interesting. So all of this is mixed up with the sort of philosophical ramblings of the author and frequent quotations from Shakespeare and poetry. So it's good. I really enjoyed it. I can see why it's considered a classic of Australian literature. And Joseph Furphy is sometimes called the father of the Australian novel, which I'm not sure whether that's accurate or not, but that's what he gets called. So yeah, it was a lot of fun to read and to produce for standard ebooks. Oh, the other thing I suppose I should say is that I always have to choose a cover for these books for standard ebooks, and that can be quite a challenge because we've got to be able to prove that they're in the public domain, and not merely in the public domain in Australia, but the public domain is considered by the United States where standard ebooks is based. Anyway, I ended up choosing a painting by Frederick McCubbin, Down on His Luck. You may be familiar with that. It's basically a swagman sitting by a fire brewing a billy tea.
Another one. Like
that. Yeah, it's good. So that worked very well as the cover, I thought. Yeah, so that was fun.
I read it a long time ago. One of those things that I should go back and reread at some point. It's a bit of a classic. Joseph Furphy, of course, is... he was originally from Shepparton, from the Furphys in Shepparton, and they were the ones that produced the water trucks. And the term of something being described as being a Furphy, namely a tall tale, comes from his family and from those trucks, because it was around those trucks that men used to stand when they wanted to drink and just tell tall tales of either what they'd shot in the bush or caught in the rivers or how big a piece of gold they found last week.
Yep.
And so Furphy's became another term for a tall tale. So,
a tall tale, yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting that he's gone into history even as that, but it is a wonderful book. I think he died in his burial in Western Australia. So he ended up over there in the end. I'm not sure why. Maybe his kids moved there and he followed them. I'm not sure. But anyway, that's where he ended up. I'm going to be talking about something a little more recent than that, although not completely recent. But my book is called The Watchtower by Elizabeth Harrower, written in 1966. And I'll hold the book up to the camera so that David can see it and our listener probably can't.
Another one of the text classics?
Another
classics
by text classic
publishing, yeah.
By text publishing with a cover by our friend Chong.
Indeed.
And this is one of his, and we'll be talking to Chong later in the episode, but we'll get to that a bit later. Now, Elizabeth Harrower didn't write terribly many books. She was born in Sydney in 1928. Her writing career started with three novels in quick succession, one in 57, 58, and then 1960. And then there was a gap for about 6 years until she wrote The Watchtower, that was released in 1966. And that was it. She had another one, a fifth novel that was due to be published in 1971, but she withdrew it from the publisher around the time of her mother's death. And seems that she just seemed to put her writing career aside. Then in 2012, the good people at Text Publishing decided to release this version of the book in their text, Australian Text Classics.
Mm.
And she was basically awarded the, later on she was awarded the Patrick White Award, which is an award for Australian writers that have not received the recognition that they should have done. People like Randolph Stowe, Gerald Manane, Amy Whiting, Gregory Day and so on have been given this award. Harrow received the award in 1996, so well before the Text Publishing, but anyway, she'd basically been forgotten. Anyway, so get to the book rather than giving all the background, or we should basically get to the book about this. It's set in Sydney during and immediately following the Second World War, and it follows the lives of the sisters Laura and Claire, whose well-loved father just dies suddenly. And as a result of that, their mother, who was from England originally, shortly after the father's death, receives a letter from home to say, well, things aren't going so well. Could you come back here? Well, she just leaves, just takes off. And so Laura's probably about 18 or 19, Claire's about 15, I just left.
Mm, goodness.
Left to their own devices. Laura was going, both of the girls were really quite intelligent, had been looking to go to college and move on to do something in a professional sense before their mother left. Oh, by the way, you never hear from the mother again. She completely leaves them. Anyway, so Laura goes to get a job in a factory, which is run by this bloke called Felix Shaw. Now, Laura is really very, very good in the office. And after a while, Felix just says, well, maybe I should marry you and that'll make it easier. And, I won't have to pay you a wage, pretty much, is what the subtext is, because that's really what he's after, almost, in a sense. So he marries her, they get a house, the sister comes and lives with them, so she becomes sort of part of the family as well. And after a while, Claire is also working in the factory and then starts giving up the whole idea of her studying any further as well, because, girls don't study, what's the point of girls studying? That's sort of not really terribly good. Now, Laura and Claire are fairly, they go along with all this because it's basically a means of their survival. They really don't have anything that they can do to look after themselves. And so they just keep on rolling with Felix because he's supplying some sort of continuity and support and base for them on which to make a life. But Felix is a bit of a monster. He's secretive about his business desire dealings. He's verbally and physically times abusive to the manipulative and controlling. And he comes to dominate everything that they do. He wants to know, he ekes out money to them. Here's a little bit of money you can have.
Familiar pattern, isn't it? Yeah,
it's a familiar pattern in the 1950s where he's completely controlling. And he moves in and out. He seems to be a completely easy mark for all of his mates who basically want to buy his businesses and give him practically nothing for them, but he thinks he's doing them a favour and that they're going to look after him. And they just tick off and just don't do anything, have anything more to do with him. So he loses out over that. He basically goes through cycles of being almost alcoholic and then completely off the wagon, and is completely different in both of those. He'll come home and just basically collapse on the floor after being down the pub and then be abusive to the two women, or he goes on the wagon and everything's fine and he's great and he gets another business and starts that back up again. And you slowly realise that this is a novel of undue influence that Felix has over these two women. It becomes a difficult book to read. It's very well written, but it's really hard to read and it's very hard to get through. But it's one of those ones where you think, you can see that even back in the 1960s, when this book was written, there were writers around like Harrower who realised what this male patriarchy society was doing to the women around them and treating them so badly. And the women sort of had no recourse other than to just lap it up. Because, of course, until about early 70s in Australia, I don't think the women on their own, if they were married, were allowed to have a bank account on their own. And this sort of thing. So it is difficult, but it is certainly worthwhile reading. It's a fantastic book, but it is a difficult read. But I think it's a classic of Australian literature all the same, a modern classic, and one of those ones that I'm glad that Text Publishing put out. I think it's very good. I gave it 4.3 out of 5, but it's a tough read, and I need to warn you, it is a tough read.
Yeah, sure. That's good. That series of Australian classics put out by Text are great, aren't they? It's a really, really good series.
Oh, there's some real crackers in that. I mean, we basically talked about the Madeleine St. John book, A Wild Beat, Women in Black, which is just brilliant. Everybody that I know that's read that now has told me that they think it's just wonderful.
It's a lovely book.
It just sparkles. It's just tremendous. Yeah. But they've done a heck of a lot of other stuff as well. There's hundreds of the things.
Yeah.
Things like My Brilliant Career, Teller Australis by Matthew Flinders, The Glass Canoe by David Island. If you want a drinking book, that won the Miles Franklin Award. That one's there. Gerildery Letter, which I spoke to you about in regards to the austerity books.
A bit too short for our purposes then, yeah.
A bit too short. But and even things like The Dying Trade by Peter Corris, the first in his detective series, and The Plains by Gerard Benane. So there's a lot of interesting material that they've put out, and certainly I'd recommend that people search them out, because I think you'll find that unfailingly they're excellent books.
Indeed. All right, well, I'm going back to Australian classics again, and of course that's what I've been working on. So the major project I've been working on is over the last few weeks is Robbery Under Arms, and I'll explain why it's been such a major task. I mean, it's an ongoing task. I haven't actually finished producing it completely for Standard eBooks. Anyway, I'll get to that. So Robbery Under Arms has a subtitle. The subtitle is A Story of Life and Adventure in the Bush and in the Goldfields of Australia, which is a pretty accurate subtitle. It was published in serial form in the Sydney Mail newspaper between July 1882 and August 1883. It was published under the name of Rolf Baldrywood. Now, that's a pseudonym. It's a pseudonym for someone called Thomas Alexander Brown with an E, who was a police magistrate and gold commissioner. So he kind of knows what he knew what he was talking about in the book. So it's really an entertaining adventure story told from the first person point of view of Richard or Dick Marston, M-A-R-S-T-O-N. And the story is in the form of a journal, Such as Life. It's written in the form of a journal, so in the first person, purportedly written from jail where he's waiting to be hanged for his crimes. And Dick Marston and his brother Jim are led astray as young men, just sort of in their teens, by their father, who has been making a lot of his money by cattle duffing or stealing, basically, sort of, rounding up cattle and changing the brands and then selling the cattle. And their father introduces them to his associate, who's known only as Captain Starlight, and he's a clever and charming fraudster. Anyway, under Starlight's command, the group manage to round up no less than 1,000 cattle, and they disguise the brands, and then they herd these 1,000 cattle overland all the way to Adelaide, where they're sold for a handsome sum before the police are aware that anything's gone on. But eventually, Dick Marston is eventually captured by police after visiting his mother and sister at the family home, and the police cop him out just outside. His brother manages to escape, but he gets copped. So he spends a spell in jail, and then eventually he escapes with the help of Starlight and Starlight's associate. And so they escape, and then they decide that this cattle duffing business isn't really profitable enough, it's too much work. And so they're persuaded by Starlight to operate as essentially as highwaymen bush rangers and bank robbers. And they therefore they embark on this life which is continually on the run from the police. But despite this, Dick and Jim also manage to find time to spend time on the gold fields and spend time prospecting for gold. And this pretty good description of the gold, how the gold rush operated, and the there's a good description of this fictitious gold town of Turon in New South Wales. It's a good set of descriptions, very interesting sort of stuff. Now, apparently, the character of Captain Starlight is based on some true stories. It's based largely on the real-life exploits of bush rangers Harry Redford and Thomas Smith. The latter was known as Captain Midnight, so you can see where he gets the Captain Starlight thing from. So basically, they lead this life of crime, but it's really entertaining stuff. And while there's plenty of Victorian era moralising, you know, sort of Dick spends, because he's in jail waiting to be hung, so he spends a lot of the time when he's telling the story of saying, "Oh, you know, if only we hadn't been led astray, and if only the devil hadn't persuaded us to do this, and so on." So, you know, it's all these excuses as to how they got into this sort of life of crime, and you know, how no one else should do what he's been doing. But they do. He and his brother Jim, in particular, are depicted really quite sympathetically, and they do manage to do a number of good deeds along with the bad. And when they are finally apprehended, and Jim and the spoiler here, and Jim and Starlight are killed by the police, you really sort of have a strong emotional impact. And you sort of, oh no. Anyway, now I've got to talk about why it's been a struggle to do this for Standard eBooks. It's because the novel first appeared in the newspaper, but then a three-volume book version came out in 1888. Followed by one volume abridged version in 1889. Now, this abridged version is the one which got reprinted again and again and again. It's never been out of print. But this version cuts out some 29,000 words from the original serial. And we don't like that at Standard eBooks. We want to be able to publish the full version. And so I'm now in the process of trying to restore the missing bits by working from the scans of the newspaper on Trove. Perry talked about Trove and his work for that in our episode on volunteering a couple of episodes ago. So the newspaper text has been run through optical character recognition, which does a sort of okay job, but not great. A lot of it's been corrected by volunteers, but it's still very, very rough. And so I'm having to work very carefully to sort of get it into shape for publication. And Perry here is kindly helping me by proofreading these cleaned up transcriptions that I'm doing. So that's a lot of work, but it will be worth it in the end. And you look, putting these bits in, you sort of realize that the abridgment, which was done back in 1889, was done very clumsily. And there's quite a number of passages in that version which seem odd or puzzling. Like there's a whole chapter which starts off with their father saying, I can't remember exactly what he says, but it's basically, you know, he starts the chapter and you think he's responding to something someone said, but we didn't get the bit that was said. And you sort of look back at the previous chapter and you think, how come does that work? But now when you put the bit back in that was cut out, it makes perfect sense. But without that, it doesn't. So the original edit was really rough. And anyway, so I'm in the process of restoring all that stuff. And once I've done all that, it'll be pretty much a clean, unabridged version. And that'll be well worthwhile.
I look forward to reading the whole bits instead of little pieces that I have been reading.
Read the whole thing. Yeah, you're only seeing glimpses of it.
Oh, I'm only seeing glimpses of it. But the bit that I was reading where the Dick goes back, where they're all hanging out at The Hollow,
as it's called,
reminded me of the Hole in the Wall out of from the Hole in the Wall gang with the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So there's a lot of things that you sort of connections that you can make, and yeah, it was probably a similar sort of time as well. So gold in California and gold in Australia at the same, around about the same time. So,
that's right.
Another classic, another one that I read a long time ago, but I probably should go back and reread it.
Read the unabridged version, yeah.
Well, I will be able to now, which is good. So being able to get the whole thing rather than sort of sitting there and think, what the hell? I've never been sure about why some writers decide that they want to throw a chapter break in the middle of a conversation.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Always find that really weird.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a particular set of books by Roger Zelazny called, you know, the Amber series, where he finishes the whole novel in the middle of a conversation, and you pick up the next one, and it just carries on. Oh, it's sort of like, oh, I've got to that number of words, draw a line through the middle of that, split it between, yeah, that'll do. Oh, you know, we're only allowed to have 185 pages, that'll do, yeah. Finish now. Odd. And there are sometimes when I'm reading books where you think, why? I can't work out why the chapters are thrown where they are. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
And every now and again you get one author that does it weirdly all the time. And you think, don't get this at all. Anyway, so that's just me. Yes, it is me indeed. I just find things a little strange sometimes.
Oh, no, I think I'm with you.
Yeah, just odd. We'll have to try and find some and discuss them and sort of work out what the hell people have done. Well, I'm moving a fair way away from Robbery Under Arms, but still staying with an Australian... Well, it is a book because it's a standalone... It's a novella that's been published as a standalone book. I bought the e-book version of this, so... from Subterranean Press. This is a novella by Greg Egan, Dispersion. Now, Greg has the distinction of having exactly the same birthday as I do, although I've never met him, and very few people in Australia have. He's a West Australian author. Oddly enough, he went to primary school with our mutual friend Julian Warner.
Mm.
Odd. But he also... turned up at the 1985 Worldcon, of which you were the chair, David. But I believe that he only stayed for half a day. He is not overly keen on crowds, decided there were too many people there. But Lucy Sussex says that she actually met him while he was there.
Yeah, well,
so Lucy is probably one of the few people around that has ever met him.
Yeah. Now, doesn't he boast that there are no photographs of him on the internet, which is a pretty remarkable claim to make.
Exactly. Somehow or other, he has got to the point where he has made sure there are no photos of him on the internet anywhere. So how he's done that, I don't know. But anyway, that's where he is. Now, Greg Egan is arguably Australia's greatest ever hard science fiction writer. Since 1983, he's produced some 14 novels and 8 collections of his shorter fiction. He's won the Hugo Award, the Locus Award, the John W. Campbell Maury Award, and the Japanese Shuen Award for Best Translated Fiction on 7 occasions. The Japanese love him, absolutely love him. But I've read a few of his novels, but I've always thought that his shorter fiction was better than his novels. I think that he basically gets a little bit carried away with his novels, and that he's tighter with his short fiction. Maybe that's just a personal preference, I don't know, but that's just what I like. Anyway, but this one, not sure what he's done with this, but anyway. Now, the world of this novella is set in a sort of a rural England... probably a rural England, rural Europe style of world. Now, this is a world that is composed of material that is made up of 6 different factions. No, he doesn't explain what the factions are, but factions. These factions can only interact with each other momentarily. So in a short space of time over a period, and then they go around not interacting again. Now, in this particular unknown country in which this novella is set, there are 6 villages are representatives of 1 faction each. But there's a new thing that's come in, and that's a virus, which is a flesh-eating cancer called the Dispersion. Don't know what's called that, but anyway. That seems to impact all 6 of these factions. And each village blames the arrival of this particular virus on the others. The novella's main character's aim is to work to understand what the interactions between the different factional materials are, hopefully therefore being able to find a cure for this particular disease. And so she meets up with somebody who is dying of the disease, but is a very brilliant young mathematician and is able to supply her with a number of pointers in terms of how she should go along with her research. Now, this is a really peculiar worldview that, you know, you can go to a village that's like 3-4 kilometres away, like half a day's walk away, and walk into them, and you're completely invisible to the people that are there. But you can actually interact with them in the sense of pushing things over or grabbing things, and it's a very bit odd. Strange. It is a bit strange. It's a peculiar world, and it's probably only one that Egan could really come up with. It reads like he set up a peculiar mathematical model and he wanted to make a story around it. As a result, the characters are more secondary to the initial overriding idea that he's trying to put across. I don't think this gets to his usual standard because it sort of left me for dead a fair bit. I was reading this and I'm thinking, well, I know, yeah, look, I know what he's trying to do. And it's very interesting and it's a good idea and a good concept. I just don't know whether he's bought it off. I originally gave this a 3.5, but I'm really thinking I should drop it down to about a 3.3 because it should be down, shouldn't be round up to a 4. I don't think it needs to come down. It's an interesting but strange novella. If you like Greg Egan's work, I think you will really like this one. If you're new to Greg Egan's work, I would not start here.
Start with this one.
I don't think you'd ever go back to it.
Yeah.
But interesting.
Yeah, because Egan himself is actually a pretty advanced mathematician.
Yep.
Didn't he solve some long-standing mathematical puzzle relatively recently? I think he did. I can't remember now what it was, but it was to do with combinations of things, I think. But he's a pretty smart guy, and maybe he's sometimes a little bit too smart in his fiction. I don't know. I haven't read a lot of his work.
Well, it's too smart for me anyway, put it that way.
Yeah. Well, anyway, yeah, I haven't read a lot of his work. All right, well, I'll go on to my next book, which I not only hadn't read before, but had never heard of before. And I owe this one, this is again a book for Standard eBooks, and I owe this one to the suggestion by our friend Lucy Sussex. And this is The Black Opal by Catherine Susanna Pritchard. Now, again, I hadn't heard of this author before, but she's a really interesting character. She was born in 1883 to Australian parents who were then living in Fiji. But she grew up in Tasmania and then lived for a while in both Melbourne and London before finally settling in Western Australia. And one of her claims to fame is that she was one of the co-founders of the Communist Party of Australia in 1921. And this, you know, her status as a communist and a female writer led to frequently being under surveillance and harassment by the Australian police and other government authorities. So a very interesting sort of person. The Black Opal was published in 1921 as well. And the novel focuses on, it's all about opal mining, focuses on the very close-knit opal mining community living and working on a place called Fallen Star Ridge, which is a fictitious location set in New South Wales. And life is pretty tough for the miners as their fortunes rise and fall with the amount and quality of the black opal that they can uncover. Now, black opal is this, if you aren't aware, is a beautiful mineral with fiery gleams of colour, and it's very much valued for jewellery. But finding productive seams of good quality opal is a matter of both hard work and good luck. So despite the difficulties that the individual miners face, the book sort of makes out this very powerful community spirit and a general agreement on basic values and principles of behaviour at Fallen Star Ridge. But this community of shared endeavour is eventually jeopardised by the influence of outsiders, as these things happen. In particular, there's an American who wishes to buy up all the individual mines and operate them under a company structure and simply pay the miners a salary. And so this is an important theme of the book, this conflict between capitalism, you know, sort of crony capitalism or corporate, you know, corporate values, and the honest manual labourer, you know, becomes one of the important themes of the work. So you can see the sort of communist philosophy sort of behind that. You know, the workers are the good guys, and the capitalists are the bad guys. So, but that's all right. That's kind of not to the fore in the book, because the real interest of the book is focused on two main characters, And there, Michael Brady, who is an older man, I think he's 45, something like that, he's very much respected by the other miners. He reads a lot, self-taught. He reads a lot, and the other miners respect him for his knowledge and his ethical approach to things. And the other character is a young a teenage girl who's a beautiful teenage girl who's called Sophie Ruminov. And she's kind of grown up in the community, and she's kind of the darling of the camp. And she can sing beautifully because she's inherited this from her mother, who was an opera singer. Now, her mother has actually died at this, the start of the book. And her father, Paul Ruminov, is a kind of never-do-well sort of character, one of the miners, but he's never succeeded very well. He often gets himself very, very drunk. He's desperate to make a good find of opals, but he's never really struck it good. But so we end up with this interesting ethical dilemma that Michael finds himself in due to his fondness for Sophie and respect for Sophie. So her father, Paul, is in partnership with someone called Jun, that's just J-U-N, Jun Johnson. And eventually these two do strike a good seam of black opal. And on the night when Johnson and Paul split up their best finds, on the way home from the hotel, Paul is now staggeringly drunk, and he's being helped to walk home by another miner called Charlie. Now, Michael Brady sees this pair walking along, and they can't see him. He's concealed behind, you know, in the darkness at the time. And he sees this pair coming along, and he sees Charlie lift the packet of opals from Paul's jacket, stick it in his own pocket. Now, Michael then struggles with two impulses. On the one hand, he wants to see justice done and for Paul to profit from his labours, and for Charlie, you know, to get his just desserts and not to enjoy his ill-gotten gains. On the other hand, Michael knows that if Paul does regain his opals and sell them, he'll take Sophie away and take her to Sydney and put her on the stage as a singer. So, and Michael can't bear the thought that this is going to happen. So rather than confronting Charlie, he sneaks into Charlie's hut later on, gets the packet that Charlie's stolen from Paul, and substitutes a packet of his own, which looks identical, but it's full of much cheaper and less valuable opals. And he takes away the packet that Charlie had stolen from Paul. Now, he intends to return these valuable opals to Paul at some time in the future, perhaps when Sophie's older and able to make her own decisions and decide where she wants to go. But other events intervene, and eventually Sophie, she's fallen in love with the son of the local landowner, but she gets disappointed and sort of snubbed at a big ball that they held. And so she actually abruptly leaves her father and the town on her own initiative. And despite this blow, Michael still can't bring himself to return these stolen opals to Paul. There's something just stopping him doing that. So it's a really interesting look at this sort of ethical dilemma and how it eventually resolves. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really, really good book. And all these different themes, the theme of the workers and the corporations and this sort of ethical dilemma that Michael gets himself into. So I really, really enjoyed it a lot. I don't give scores quite the way that Perry does, but I'd certainly give this a 4.5 or 4.4, something like that.
Yeah, well, I'm aware of Catherine Susanna Pritchard. Auslit, the people that I do some work for out of the University of Queensland, tweeted a few years ago that they thought that her name was the hardest of any Australian author to remember how to spell.
Oh, yes, yes.
Catherine with a K, Pritchard doesn't have a T or a D or a T in the middle. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Catherine with an A-I in the middle.
Yeah, Susanna, is it one S or two? Is it one N or two N's? I mean, yeah. So anyway, a difficult name to spell. But I think she did a whole series of reports from Russia back in the 20s, probably in the Herald or Sydney Morning Herald, I'm not sure which one. Mm. But she travelled around a fair bit in Europe when she was living there and wrote some travel logs for the Australian newspapers, and I've come across those, but I haven't, and I've logged them, but I haven't basically had a chance to read them. There's Far too much to read, David.
That's right, yeah.
Far too much.
Yeah, she was obviously a remarkable character, so.
Yep. Yeah, well, speaking of remarkable characters, characters that actually lived, Australian characters that lived in London, my next book is the second volume in the autobiographical series by Clive James that is published under the overriding title of Unreliable Memoirs. That was the title of the first volume, which I talked about last year on the podcast. The second volume was called Falling Towards England, published in 1985. Auspicious year for you, David, 1985. So this is this sequel is a straight continuation of the work that was in the first. That one ended with him sitting on the boat looking at the lights of England coming up on the horizon and wondering what was going to happen to him. This one starts from when he lands at Southampton after his trip from the boat, at a time when he's woefully unprepared for just about anything. He's got the wrong clothing, the wrong shoes, doesn't have any money. He's always attempted to ingratiate himself with people, can't find a job, can't hold that down. He drinks too much, he smokes too much. He's just scrounges as a living by being an unrepentant male oaf, really. James is fully aware of what he was doing and actually sort of sends him up a bit. And this book covers the period from when he lands in London lands in the UK, to when he finally decides that he's actually going up to Cambridge, because he had to basically try and get somebody to give him a reference to get a scholarship to go there. And the idea was that he does this halfway through the book, and the book writes, the college in Cambridge that he's going to writes back and says, oh, yeah, well, we normally want you to have lived and looked after yourself for 3 years before you can come up, see you in 3 years. And, of course, he just can't make that time. So yeah, he sends him off some sob story about how badly he's doing. So they chop it by a year. So he's got 2 years to hang around and work his way through to basically getting to the point where he can actually go to Cambridge. So like in the first book, if you read what's going on, if you look closely at what's there, you can start realising that he's done a sort of tuckerisation, as it's called in the SF field, of people's names. So he's changed the names around a bit. So you can tell that Bruce Beresford is there, that he stays with Bruce Beresford, the film director, that he works with on trying to get a screenplay together. Sort of doesn't work all that well. Brett Whiteley is in the book hanging around with his wife. And Barry Humphries seems to be lurking in the background because he's referred to as somebody that had left Australia some years before as being the first wave. And, of course, James, Robert Hughes and Jermaine Greer were the next wave that came through in about 1962. So this is a good continuation of the book. It's an easy read and it's funny, he takes the piss out of himself the whole time. And you can see that although he's trying to give you a true indication of what he was like, he's fully aware of the fact that he really wasn't that nice a bloke back then, that he sort of took advantage of people and he didn't do what he should have done. And he's not nasty to anybody in any great extent. It's just that there's a certain point where you've got obligations to people. If you borrow money from them, you really should pay it back. And he actually starts by saying that he borrowed 20 quid off somebody back in 1962, and he still hasn't paid it back, and that was 20-odd years later. So while it's not as funny as the first volume, it's still worth reading, and it's just a breath of fresh air after me having to struggle reading a very, very long book, which I shall talk about at some point in the future. And this was just an easy read that just flowed through. Still good stuff. I gave it a 4 out of 5. The other one was about 4.4. So as I said, not as good as the first volume, but by any stretch, still pretty funny and still a good book to read.
Well, speaking of very long books, I thought very briefly mention the fact that I did actually manage to work my way through The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson, which was your recommendation.
Good man.
I have to say, he's not an author I like much, but of all the books of his that I've read, I think I probably like this the most. It certainly starts with the bang with this very harrowing chapter about the heat wave in India. And it's interesting, but I'm not sure it succeeds as a novel. It's a polemic. It's a blueprint for how we might get through the climate problems. I didn't much like the intervening little riddles. You know,
No, I love those.
I am the sun. I am a carbon atom.
No, I like those. I thought they were good.
So anyway,
different strokes.
I did manage to get through it. I did read it. So of all his books that I've read, I think I liked it more than any of those I read. So that's as far as I'll go. Now, I believe that you will you chatted about this book too with your friend, W.H. Chong.
He does mention it, yes. As last week, we had Lucy Sussex talking about her best reads of 2020. This time, we have W.H. Chong reprising his appearance last year about the same time of year with his books, Best Reads of 2019. This time, 2020, and I started by asking him how he got on in 2020 with his reading. Chong, how was 2020 for your reading? How did you go? Can you tell us what your best books were for the year?
For the first time in years, I kept a list of the books I read.
Oh, good.
So
man.
I actually know what the hell it was that went past my bedside table.
You knew I was going to come back and talk to you again. That's why you did this. It's very good. I like this.
This is advice. I recently came across somebody's Instagram, and it was an advice given by the recently departed Olga Lorenzo to her editing and writing students. Keep a list of what you read. And when you finish reading it.
Yes. Yes, I think this is an excellent idea.
Which I've never really done because I keep forgetting.
Well, you're just going to get into the habit of putting it down straight away. And if you do that straight away, then it becomes second nature and you just add it straight in. See, maybe later on I'll show you my spreadsheet and you can see how intricate and detailed the whole thing is.
It's just that I've operated under the assumption that most of what I read is entirely unimportant, irrelevant, not memorable. I will forget it. If I don't forget it, then it counts. If I do forget it, so what?
I disagree with that. I think that everything that you read is important. But we're moving away from the topic of it. We will have to have this as another topic of conversation. But how did it... So you last year, your big change was the idea that you are listing everything you read. How did you think your reading went in 2020? A number of people have said that they thought they actually had trouble concentrating and reading in 2020 because of the pandemic. How did you find it?
My life didn't change much because I work from home and have for years. So really, it was per normal, except less distractions. And, you know, because I'm among a bunch of people who are lucky enough not to have got sick or lost a job or had terrible circumstances or lived at home with kids and had to teach or whatever. So it didn't really affect me. So I have no excuse for having read less or more, really.
Okay. All right. So what were your best five books of, or your best books? I shouldn't give it to five, but you might have done. But what were your best books of?
Well, my best book, I mean, we're talking about the ones which I enjoyed the most, maybe? I'm not really sure how you put this. I would regard them as the books I enjoyed the most, which I thought had some kind of that special thing called quality, which it makes it not entirely frivolous activity. So my best book of the year came right at the end, which was Kim Stanley Robinson's The Mystery for the Future. And I had been hanging out for it because there's a lot of advance kind of notice in all the places that one might hear about quality genre. And there it was, this big fat monster of a thing, which frankly I find quite frightening because anything over 300 odd pages, I just don't feel like I have any stamina for anymore. And this was considerably more than that, and I finished it in 3 or 4 days, which astonishes me. So I must have either rushed past important stuff or it was just incredibly readable.
I think it was the latter. I think it's just an incredibly readable book, but one of those ones which I think I'm going to have to go back and have a look at again in another 12 months.
What did you think was important?
Yes. I think it is the important SF novel of the year.
Because of the subject matter about climate change, imminence and the politics?
All of that, plus also his style and the way that he approached it. And it's also important because he's actually come out and stated that he thinks that it might be his last book. His last novel, in which case it is an important thing, even if it's just that, as a full stop on his novelistic career.
Yeah, I'm not very impressed by extramural information. But it did seem to me that it had the qualities of being an edgy handbook for activists as well as bureaucrats.
Yeah.
The terrible things you could do to make things happen.
Yes, but also here's some of the solutions that you've got in your hands at the moment without you having to do lots of things that you're not pulling a rabbit out of the hat to be able to solve this problem. You've got everything with you. You just have to go with the idea that...
But we know that, Perry.
Yeah, we know that.
The problem is politics, and that's what this book is so interesting about, because the solutions to politics are not being nice.
No.
And that's what's terrifying about the book.
That sometimes in the book, there are some people that basically refer to the fact that, well, yes, there are black ops. You're probably better off not knowing about them and just letting it go. And there are some things that happen and you think, this is an act of terrorism that is being undertaken here. But is it going to end up getting the result you want? And what's your feeling about that? We could have a massive discussion about this particular book.
Well, you could. So one of the most interesting things about this book is... despite myself, the extramural information, and it comes from some interviews Stanley Robinson has given, and he's very, very interesting about the notions of terrorism, what's regarded as terrorism, what is eco-terrorism, what is actually tit-for-tat. So he talks about things like slow violence, which is what corporate kind of activities that degrade the earth are. And the first 12 pages of the novel are about what happens in the real world when these things get out of hand because of corporate activities. And the first 12 pages are monstrous and horrifying. And this is a very good kind of a believable impetus for doing things which aren't conventionally regarded as legal or acceptable.
Hmm.
Because the way that corporations behave aren't actually kosher. You know, it might perfectly legal, maybe, but, you know, certainly not to anyone's benefit apart from their stockholders' purses or their owners.
Food for thought.
And then I read a whole bunch of other funny things. The one which I find most memorable is Piranesi by Susanna Clarke. And anyone who loved Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell would already know how well she writes. But there's something very special about Piranesi. The tone, which is so beautifully maintained, has this marvelous silvery quality that's both serious but not heavy somehow. And the story is so peculiar, mysterious, and enormous, but at the same time, it's a very compact fable, which is almost like a perfect kind of book format for me. And the character, the protagonist, is so gorgeous a characterization and such a gorgeous innocence about him. I just kind of fell in love with the whole thing, really.
Have you reread
it? It's delicious. I very rarely reread books. Very rarely.
Both David Grigg and Lucy Sussex, who have spoken about this particular book, have both reread it. And David's thinking that he may need to go and read it another time.
Wow.
Because he just thinks that every time he reads it, he's going to come up with something new. So it's interesting. It's a very, very interesting book.
I have an old friend in Kuala Lumpur who said to me many years ago now, when I offered him a book that I just finished, he said, "Oh no, I only read books that I've read before," which I found quite marvellous and staggering. So I imagine he's still reading the same list of books now, years later.
So there was somebody that once said that she only ever read books that she'd written. I don't know who that was, but somewhere in a film.
Lisa Kenny Curry or Elle Macpherson?
Elle Macpherson, I think it probably was. Maybe that was it. Next.
The Rain Heron by Robbie Arnott.
Yes, well, you put me onto this one and told me I should read it, and I'm very grateful that you did. I really enjoyed this one as well.
Did you read his first book, Flames?
No, not yet, but it is on the list.
So Flames is a marvellous fable and sort of a love letter to Tasmania, very magical, which he tells you in the first page, so you have no excuse for feeling like you've been tricked later on. The Rain Heron is a... So it would fall into the idea of cli-fi, but is really more of a climate fable. And he has this a wonderful framing device at the start, which is literally a fable about a bird called the Rain Heron and the destruction of the land and the climate because of bad human practices. And the rest of the novel becomes a very complicated, sort of emotionally complicated tale about trying to find our way back from the edge of the abyss with the way we deal with our own responses to the climate situation. This is, I guess, it's, in other words, I'm saying it's a novel. You can't really boil it down so simply. And it's all in the quality of the writing. His writing is superbly original, I think. He does not suffer a cliche.
I just thought it was very smooth in his writing. I don't know how... That makes sense to me, but it's one of those adjectives that you use and you think, yeah, how do I explain this to somebody else? I didn't ever get jolted out of the text at all, and I just flowed beautifully all the way right through, and I didn't feel as though he was dealing with difficult and interesting concepts, but he wasn't making them so difficult that you were falling over the words that he was using. It just flowed beautifully all the way right through. It's a lovely book.
Yeah, and like Robinson, he doesn't do exposition.
No. Robinson does a lot of that, but he does it in different ways.
He makes it a virtue, Robinson.
He does. And he works on getting it in there, but Robbie Arnott doesn't in this instance. Yeah.
No, no. The thing about that book and some of the bits of Robinson and pretty much all Piranesi are how memorable the images are. And if I feel like I've read a book a while ago and I can remember whole scenes from it, I figure that's a pretty good get on me by the author.
It's how long the aftertaste lasts, really.
That sounds bad.
No. The aftertaste is not necessarily...
It's like it's chicken or something.
No, it's a bit like wine in the mouthfeel. You know, that basically that... Well, you put a glass of wine, or a sip of wine into your mouth, and does it fill up the whole thing? And do later on that you sit there and you think, I can still taste this, like... 20, 30 minute
talking
later.
To a non-wine drinker.
Oh, well, okay, sorry. Well, that sort of metaphor is a bit of a waste of time then, isn't it, really? Why do I waste my best metaphors on people that don't understand them?
You have to find a new set of friends.
Oh, okay. Now, what was that great line from Red Simons? I don't need any new friends. I don't even like the ones I've already got. But that was Mr. Grumpy to the nth degree.
No, that's why you need new friends, because you can't stand the ones you've got.
Next.
I'd like to mention Underland by Robert McFarlane. The reason why I read Underland, I'm still reading it, by the way, because I'm reading bits and not rushing it, is because you put it on your list. In fact, I think it was your favourite book, possibly, of like 2 years ago.
Close to, yeah. It was certainly up there in the top five of the year, yeah.
And I recently saw it in a bookshop, and on the flap of the paperback edition was a list of about maybe three dozen names, and it was all bracketed under the rubric best books of the year according to
I wasn't on it.
Next three dozen people.
I wasn't on it. How are Kill Surprise?
It's a marvel.
It is.
How would you, what is your one sentence description of Underland?
No, I couldn't do it in one sentence. I just thought it was it almost comes across as a fantasy novel, in the sense that you're digging into a world that you really have never seen before.
Is that a pun?
No, yeah. But it is that way. It wasn't intended as a pun.
The reason why I say it could have been a pun is because Underland is the story of what happens beneath our feet.
Yes, and it is a world that none of us really understand to any great degree. I mean, we might think we do, but we don't. You know, the idea of trees communicating via root structures, fungi and root structures is, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but it is actually perfectly true, and is now being proven as being such. He travels to a dark matter observatory in a long disused mine, either coal or gold, I can't remember which one. He travels underground through, under the hills of Paris. It's amazing stuff, and he writes beautifully. And it's one of those ones, again, I think I need to go back and have a look at yet again. It reminded me a bit of Sebald. But then a lot of things remind me of Sebald that are like this. I'm not sure why, but he does.
So. He does not remind me of Sebald at all.
Okay, well, just go to there, you see. Just different strokes.
No. See, I think Sebald is about memory as the matrix for recognition. And Underland is sort of a revelation, yet another one of how little we know about the world in which we live.
Well,
it's not one person's story, it's the world's story.
Well, he's talking about the underland reflecting what's happening up above as well, and mm-hmm. how that impacts and how also, it changes his view of what's happening upstairs.
Well, a great deal of what he talks about is non-human activity, which is the bit that gets me.
That is very interesting.
It's mind-expanding what he tells about trees and fungi.
Yep.
And naked salamander under the Slovenian hills.
Yeah, it's good.
Beautiful book. And then I have a bunch of stuff that I imagine no genre reader would come within a... What is our standard?
Bull's Roar.
Okay, Bull's Roar. So I have books about art and poetry, which I will not discuss.
But you read it widely across different genres last year, as you normally would?
I'm not a single genre reader because why would one be?
You shouldn't be.
No.
You need to read lots of different things. I don't know whether I've run this theory of mine past you, but for me, reading's like food. Well, it is food for the soul. No, it's basically every now and again, you want a pizza. You want something short, sharp, and sweet. You want it to be good. You know, you want it to be delivered directly through to you. You want to rush through it, like a good thriller, a good Jack Reacher novel. Other times, you want to sit and luxuriate in a large banquet that takes a long time to work your way through. But you don't have the same food day after day after day. If you do that, then it all blends out and it all sort of fades into each other. And you need to spread yourself around. Every now and again, you need to have some Szechuan. And every now and again, you need to have a smoked chicken. Or you need to have an Indian curry or a Thai curry or just a straight well-cooked steak on a barbecue. That sort of thing. You just need to spread your stuff around. And to do that, if you think about reading that way, then you look at all that different stuff as well.
Perry, you're merging your two favourite activities.
The food and reading. Food and eating. Food and reading, yeah, that's it.
Don't read while you're eating. You might ruin the food or your appetite.
No, I do that. So, all right. Anything that you want to finish up with? Is there anything that you got out of the year that you thought was important? Obviously, Underland... you we've been talking about this on and off for a while, and you have been reading it for a while, so you're just dipping in and underland.
Right.
Dipping into it a bit here and there.
I'm a very slow reader, so if a book is in bits and I don't feel like I need to remember the story from one to the next, then it can stay by my bedside for a very long time. Poetry books do that, of course.
Yes. Well, you can go back into poetry and re-dip into them and just go back over and over and over and
over. You know, I can reread poetry. That's one thing I can do. In fact, you have to, really.
Yes.
And because you could actually read a poem within a few minutes.
The poet that I'm thinking that I'm going to have to follow up is the young woman who spoke at Biden's inauguration. And I thought the poetry that she, The Hill We Have to Climb, I think it was called, that I'm going to have to go back to again, because I thought it was quite excellent.
Well, I thought it was a fantastic performance. I'm not super impressed by the poetry, but she's a fantastic performer. I did read this thing last year, which they're all raving about this year, which is the new Beowulf translation by Maria Devana Headley. And of course, that is sort of a genre thing in itself, Beowulf. Yes. And she starts the poem in a sort of a already celebrated way. So it's been started in different ways by different people. Seamus Heaney used, did he say behold, maybe? No, he didn't say behold. It was something else. Anyway, so Maria Devana Headley begins with this word, bro. As in yo, bro. She really does. And that sets the tone for her revisionist translation. And it is an actual proper translation.
Okay.
And she takes a somewhat feminist angle. And more importantly, the feminist thing comes through in her characterization of the essentially toxic masculinity of the cast of bros that this story revolves around. So that's very interesting. I actually found the language to be slightly distracting for me, because she uses quite a lot of contemporary anachronistic locutions. But, you know, everybody else raves about it, so I know I'm wrong, but it did distract me.
All right. Well, we might have to have a look at that.
There you go. Thank you so much, Perry.
Thank you, John. We'll talk to you again in 2022 about your best one. So don't forget, keep on writing those books down. Thanks very much. Thanks, John, for that. That's good. It's always good to listen to, and also good to hear that he's keeping track of what he's reading now.
Yes.
I think that might be my fault, but he'll probably blame me for that at some point or other in the future. But that's okay.
Thing to do.
Oh, well, I think it is. I think just, I don't know about you, but I forget.
Absolutely.
I am reading a fair bit of stuff, and I'm actually forgetting unless I actually keep track of it. I'm even now getting to the point, because I'm doing a whole lot of reading of short science fiction from 1965, David.
That's going to be coming up, isn't it?
Well, it's coming up in a couple of episodes, the 1965 Hugo Awards. I've got to hit the novels, but I'm doing a lot of reading in 1965 short fiction for a piece that I'm writing, which I'll talk about sometime in the future. And it's an interesting year, in my view, because it's sort of that changeover period from sort of the older 50s style into moving into more of a literate style coming up. And a number of authors that we would all know very well are starting to make their mark. I mean, people like Alison Zelazny, Larry Niven, for example.
Le Guin.
Are all basically starting to come to the fore that weren't there very much previously. And so that's something that we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. So, a month or so, I think, because next episode we're talking about crime fiction.
Crime again.
Back to crime again. So we've got some interesting crime fiction that we want to have a chat about, because there's always a lot of good stuff floating around in that genre as well.
There is indeed.
All right. I think we're done.
We are.
Thanks, David. We shall talk again in a couple of weeks.
Indeed. See you then.
See ya. Bye.